and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 608.
That's right. We're talking about quite a few things tonight. First double issue review in a while, actually, right? We haven't done this in a good long time.
Yeah, I didn't bother to look to see when, but no matter what. While it may all be relative, the reality is, yeah, it has to be a long time since we've been trying to keep these things clean and separate, but there's been so many issues, and there's been so many other things that we know we're going to want to talk about, that this seemed kind of the best time to double up on two non-canon titles, throw them together.
And to be fair, folks, Mark and I, when we took over the show, started doing this whole thing with like four issues an episode at one point, right? So
thanks, Jim and Dan.
Well, we were playing catch up, so yeah, it only made sense to.
We were playing catch up, but part of the why we were playing catch up, because if I remember correctly, they weren't really feeling the vibes of what was going on, which is why they left the show. But then that's part of the reason why things backed up, because it was not as compelling to go pump these things off 1, 2, 3 as soon as possible. But yeah, we got through it.
Yeah. Tonight we will be talking about Absolute Green Lantern number 4 and Green Lantern Dark number 5, as well as Mark and I both actually saw Jurassic Park Rebirth or Jurassic World Rebirth last weekend. So we have something to talk about as well.
Yep. There's a bunch of stuff in this episode. So.
All right. So where do we want to start?
Let's do Absolute, because I have it open.
All right. Well, let's do Green Lantern Dark, because I have it open.
We can flip a coin.
No, it's fine.
I figure, honestly, Absolute's better, because if there's going to be any more to talk about one of the two issues than the other, it might be this one. It's not necessarily true, but I just figured if there was going to be a lengthier discussion, I come somehow suspected probably would be related to Absolute, but maybe not.
Let's do it.
All right. So we begin with the ever-present internal monologue between rings and things, talking to whoever the hell the host is and everything else. This is how the duality going inside here is like Hal Jordan judgment was made, but penance can be. I kind of like that. It's kind of Spectre-esque. And it's like a penance. It's like, you were right. You were right. You were always right. And it's like, all this stuff, the truth is there for all to see. God is not a ring of light. God is a big black zero, the dark circle around everything. And inside the circle is a single black star. Be the black star.
As nebulous as always.
Yeah. And it just comes across as kind of pretentious anyway, with that, be the black star, Hal. But so this takes us back to where we left off with Joe kind of blasting Hal, trying to get Hal to snap out of it, which I do like the twist they give us in this, which we'll get to in a few seconds. That, you know, Joe's kind of deriding Hal, saying, "Hey, you got to get control of the Black Hand. This Black Hand thing. It's like we need to fix all this. Like, come on, Hal, look at what you did." I'm assuming she's referring to the diner and everything, but that really triggers Hal, and as we find out, justifiably so. And Hal literally sends out this, you know, big Black Hand construct that grabs Joe. And her little green energy bubble slams her to the ground. Hal's yelling at her, "What I did? What happened to Evergreen, Joe?" And we see Hal almost like it's almost like a symbiotic, like a symbiote suit, except he's got like these red eye-like things all over his black costume. It's really weird. His head is still mostly Hal Jordan, but the rest of his body at this point is taken over by the Black. Now we get the flash. We go back to Evergreen, and we find out that the people of Evergreen have been disappearing. First, they thought Joe and Todd are sitting here talking at the diner, at the Alan Scott diner. And they thought all the people, you know, all the people that didn't come into town to start buying supplies and hoarding everything, they thought they were sheltering in place. But now all the evidence seems to point to the fact that they're gone. They've disappeared. And while Joe and Todd are talking, Hal shows up with the gun loaded, looking horrible in this panel, by the way. Oh, and it's like, just be careful. And Hal, you know, Hal's all ready to use those gold-plated bullets that we saw him working on at the end of last issue. We get a whole bunch of name drops here, which obviously we can discuss if we want later on, which certainly some of them, have, at the very least, what seems to resonate with us. But Joe takes a swig of like beer. She goes out. She calls out Abin Sur, like, hey, Abin Sur, I want to talk to you. Abin Sur comes down and the whole Sojourner Marlene, be without fear, blah, 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 blah. And she, you know, she kind of mans up, which was the plan. And it's like, why did you kill them all? And Abin Sur is trying to process this. It's like, because he doesn't understand what the term is. Meanwhile, Hal's aiming the gun because all he basically, according to the plan, was he just needed a clear shot. And he was going to try to take out Abin Sur. We find out that the two people that Abin Sur absolutely dead were kind of like a byproduct of what's in the plan. And part of it was Jason kind of died just because of the barrier and his relative speed. And Rita Powell was basically judged because when she shot Abin Sur, ricocheted and killed somebody else, so she was judged as guilty. And because of her chaotic action, so much like the Guardians, anything to do with chaos is frowned upon and has to be dealt with harshly. But he reiterates that nobody else has, their existence has ended in this town. And she's like, I don't understand. It's like, how can you say that? Referring to Guy, referring to John, it's like you disintegrated them. And Abin Sur repeats his point. Then all of a sudden, he takes her word. He's able to process it and translate it and understand what it means. And he points out, no, you know, Guy Gardner, John Stewart, all the other people that they were talking about in town, their existence they haven't ended. They still exist, but they exist in Oa, which, of course, here refers to the Omega and the Alpha. They are in the second stage, and their judgment remains in progress, which kind of goes along with what we suspected about John and Guy, that they're not really dead. And meanwhile, Hal has the opportunity to shoot Abin Sur, but he's not, because he's listening to what Abin Sur is saying. Plus, he believes, or he thinks, that maybe Joe can basically, you know, talk him down, or we can get enough of an understanding where this won't be necessary. Now, we find out from Abin Sur, which is interesting, that he says he is the Abin Sur, but Ayan must be selected. And apparently there's going to be three. Ayan Rao, Sur, and Aur. So initiates must be selected. Initiates against the darkness. And he says, be without fear, Sojourner Marlene. I'm going to say it's Quard, even though it's spelled Card, because we know it's supposed to be Card. It's like, fear Card, feel a weaponers, a Card, slash Quard. It's like, now you have understanding, judgment is in progress. And Joe's like, what do you mean? What do you mean? And I mean, we cut back to Hal and Joe fighting, and Hal's really ripping into Joe now. And what happened then, Joe? What did you do? And instinctively, what we find out Joe did is she reached out to Abin Sur as he kind of was going into his energy phase and form, trying to fly up in the air again. And she reached out, with her left hand, which is where her wedding ring was on, her gold, solid gold wedding ring. And when she did that, she basically reached into Abin Sur. Her hand went into the flame, and her wedding ring basically became like a conduit that not only did she go into Abin Sur, and we see these images, like we see a version of Tomar Ray and things like that. But the ring, the energy, the light also went into her. So that's why she has this green lantern ring. Abin Sur is pointing to her chaotic action. Anomaly! Anomaly! And at that moment, what happens is the connection to the sphere dissipates because Abin Sur's energy is disrupted, apparently. The sphere collapses. The big green lantern symbol that was hovering above Evergreen now has nothing to support it, so it crashes into Evergreen and completely destroys the city. Now, we cut to the end, which I'm going to assume ties into some of the things that are going on in the other Absolute books. But we find out that there's one survivor. There's someone talking to, as we're going to find out in a second, who this is. I'm going to assume this is Carol. This is Carol, even though she's never referenced, but she looks like Carol. And
dark hair, business suit, and in sapphire colors. I assume it's
Carol. That is true too. And being referenced as sweetie or honey and all these things by the big reveal of the guy whose company is investigating all this. And these events is Hector Hammond, which is interesting because like in the second to last page, he has like these gold rings on that you see. But on the last page, when he's walking off, he does not have them. So got to love continuity. But that's it. So that's the end of this issue. This issue was entitled Chaotic Action. Al Ewing, writer. Janoi Lindsay, art, color, and cover. Lucas Gattoni, letters. Juliet Necka, Alex Ekman-Lawn, Nemet. Wow, these are some interesting names. Nemet Malavia, variant covers. Ash Padilla, assistant editor. Andrew Marino, editor. Katie Kubert, group editor. And Chris Conroy, the executive editor.
Real quick, did you want to tell them what you told me about what you found out about how long this series is?
Well, see, I don't see it. It's debatable.
I don't agree. Because,
yeah, I think it's up in the air. I think, well, there was some evidence that supports, or at least supported the idea that the non-Trinity Absolute books at least were originally intended to be like five-issue books. Considering this is issue four, it's kind of really difficult to believe that this is going to end in issue five.
Yeah, we just introduced more characters. We just figured out everything.
Do we know how many issues we've had solicits for already?
I can pull that up in the background.
I think we know there's at least one more, but if we absolutely have solicits for six, then we know that's not the case here. But I believe it's possible this was the original game plan for some of these, because I believe the Martian Manhunter one was extended, that originally it was supposed to be smaller, and I think it was extended. But that's what Comic Book Revolution said. I didn't hear that anywhere else other than, but it is interesting to think that's, I guess they could give you a very unsatisfying ending to issue five or issue six, and just kind of whatever they're going to do with all these Absolute books, tying them together, that maybe get more of it. But, I like this issue. I thought it was somewhat a nice little twist, I guess, that we thought not just, I did take some satisfaction in the fact that Joe is kind of being a little holier and thou, and she's got a lot of, you know, she's got the red in her ledger too here. But more importantly, that I think we were set up for this issue more to be the Hal origin story, and we kind of get, it actually is more the Joe origin story. We still don't really have the Hal origin story.
Absolute Green Lantern number 6, solicited for release September 3rd.
All right, so we know it goes at least 6. It was interesting. Like I said, we get some answers here. We get the confirmation, like we suspected, that Guy and John are not dead, which also is interesting because if you look at the fact that Abin's apparent, if you assume what Abin is telling us, that there's going to be three initiates selected, that it's probably easy to say that John and Guy are going to be two of them. The question is, who's going to be the third? Did Joe get automatically eliminated because she's the anomaly?
And what difference is there, if any, between the different ANs or whatever? Because it seems like maybe a role as opposed to a name. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it might be exactly. It might be they serve a purpose. They may be a certain role to play. So again, if you had to bet, you would bet based on what our, and this is again based on our knowledge of the existing Green Lantern universe, plus the fact that Guy and John getting wiped out was kind of, both were kind of important events in the issues leading up to this one. You kind of assume John and Guy would be at least two of these three. And the question is, who's going to be the third? Is it somebody we don't know? Is somehow, could it be Joe, despite the fact that she seemingly is the anomaly? And of course the whole Weaponers of Kord thing, which is again a nice tie-in, which still doesn't necessarily poke holes in the idea that if they really want to do Bizarro here, yeah, we could still find out that the Weaponers of Kord actually are the good guys here. Just because Abin Sur sees them as the enemy does not necessarily mean that the Weaponers of Kord in this universe actually are bad. More setup, for a lot of setup, but at least we get a few tiny tidbits of answers.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say here. Is I don't necessarily think there is much to say about this issue, unlike what you stated at the beginning of the coverage. I just, we learned a lot, but we also, it was said and spoken by Abin in such a way that it meant nothing. You confirm that you know, so-and-so is not dead, at least according to Abin's definition of it, but his definition isn't anything other than saying they're within the light in the second stage and judgment remains in progress and they're part of Omega Alpha and all of this stuff. So, like, you could just say they're in another state of being and they have yet to be reintegrated, much like a long teleport, you know. They're disintegrated and then there's a massive pause before they're reintegrated. But other than that, like, we don't learn anything necessarily about the power. He gives names to these other people who need to be selected, but we don't know what that means. He says Fear Quard, but we don't necessarily know what that means in the context of this new universe, because we don't even know what the Green Lantern means in the terms of this new universe. So we see Tomar and we see what we assume is Sinestro, because the skin, the eyebrows, the yellow eyes with the black pupil, or sorry, the yellow pupils with black irises. And we see what looks like a black hole or whatever. And then we see the star again, but there's, again, revelation wise there's not a whole lot here.
No, I agree. I think it's just enough so far to keep me liking it. It's also, maybe it's also been because, even though, again, the irony is, you know, heading into Green Lantern Dark for like a 2-issue win streak, because we both like, you like this issue, right? I don't know if he's
yeah, I like it. I just, you know,
you
I
don't love it, but you like it.
Yeah.
So that maybe just, again, compared to what we've been having lately, that this has at least been something to look forward to, because maybe because we're looking for the answers and we haven't reached the Jeremy Adams point of where it's like, okay, we're like 8 issues in and we have like 90 questions that still need to be answered, and we have like 5 answers, and the answers aren't even satisfying to the things that have been not checked off the list. We're not at that point at all.
And maybe, but I will say the timing between issues is going to make that go faster.
What do you mean?
In terms of how long it takes to get to the next issue, I don't know. So this is issue 4, 5 would be this month, and then July is supposed to, the next month would be August, but we don't get issue 6 until September. So there's delays on this book.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Now I understand what you mean. But again, I like it for what it is. It might be easier to kind of like be more patient just because this is not in continuity. This is an entirely different universe. So it's not. Yeah. So I think that does help in this situation. But I don't want it to suffer the same fate as the Jeremy's book or War Journal, and potentially Core or something like that, where you, a lot of the goodwill that you have to start with kind of dissipates over time. But at least it's selling so far, as we'll talk about later. At least this book remains, at least during the issues that have come out that we have numbers for, at least the book is selling. So that's not what any other Green Lantern book can really say.
I don't have much else to talk about. I'm curious about the Hector Hammond stuff, and like you said, it does seem rooted in context that has to be relevant to the rest of the universe, just because none of it means anything in the context of this series, so it must mean something elsewhere. Yeah,
the stuff that he's referring to and everything. Yeah, so those are other events that have been going on in the Absolute Universe, or on Earth in the Absolute Universe. So. But yeah, which does seem a little abrupt, considering we've been literally locked into these two places, I think, the entire time in this story up until the very end of this issue, that we've been either in Evergreen or we've been in the town where Hal is, that when he got out, that the reality is, it does seem, and I got to be honest, in a way, following up, I mean, we just saw Hector Hammond, so in a way, seeing Hector Hammond again just doesn't quite work. I think it would have been cooler. I mean, it's not surprising, but I think it would have been cooler if we hadn't just seen Hector Hammond like a couple of issues ago in the main book, but it is what it is.
All right, Green Lantern Dark?
Green Lantern Dark, baby.
All right, Green Lantern Dark, number 5. This one is titled Campfires, writer Tate Bromble, artist Werther Delladera, colorist Giovanna Nero, letterer Tom Napolitano, cover Werther De La Dera and Giovanna Nero. And then we have assistant editor Ash Padilla, editor Andrea Shea, and senior editor Mark Maring, and of course the Tangent Universe, based on a concept by Mr. Dan Jurgens. We get a little bit more context as to the Eclipso spores and all the stuff that was going on, because we get a creation myth here in terms of, you know, first there was darkness, then there was light, but the darkness still remained. So the creator created something to help clean up the lingering rot in that quote unquote plagued her ever expanding creation. And so the creator created the Great Devourer. Look, we're going to talk about Galactus again this episode. The celestial worm, Urbic Doom, which is basically a giant space worm, which I guess is kind of what Galactus looked like in one of the first films, right? The weird machine twirling in the stars.
It was just a cloud, just a cloud.
But anyways, this thing's job is to hunt and feed on rot in the universe. It doesn't have a mind of its own. Again, its only purpose is to devour the darkness. So it seeks out the darkness, and it contains it all within itself. And it's a near infinite resource of darkness just waiting to be exploited. And so we catch up then with our band of merry travelers as they are making their way across New England, spreading the light. And Damona is seeing this on her little crystal ball or cosmic map or whatever it is that she's got on her side, just seeing essentially what we've been seeing at the end of every issue in terms of the map, with things like various towns lighting up and stuff like that. So she sees basically another, final boss being checked off in the progress map of the whole story. And again, we know that she's trying to get the Urk-Ba-Doom to come to the world so that it feeds and everything. So she's trying to keep things dark in order to do that, because, and I'm going to go very broad strokes here, because we do learn a lot in this issue about individual characters and stuff. So a little broad strokes here. We come to learn she is the daughter of Morgan Le Fay, another character in the DC universe. Obviously, this is a different version in another universe, but typically in Arthurian legend, sorceress, sometimes half-sister to Arthur, stuff like that. She's been in DC Comics, often involved with Merlin and the creation of the demon Etrigan and stuff like that. But anyways, she is the daughter of this universe's Morgan Le Fay, who told her one day that she would have everything, and she took her mother's magics and stuff. And what she wants to do is exploit Urk-Ba-Doom, because when it gets here, for whatever reason, which I guess we'll discuss later, she seems to believe that when it gets here, because the darkness will come there, she'll be able to take advantage of it and use it for herself, much in the same way she took her mother's magics and things like that. So anyways, in the midst of all of this, the Bat Wraith comes to confront her and says, you know, you've gone too far and things like that. And we learn that later on that Bat Wraith is Damona's father, who betrayed Arthur and things like that, and was cursed and a part of his castle. And we know what happened to him from there. Meanwhile, we asked previously, if all these pieces on the map are meant to be checked off, we only have so many issues left. How much are we going to fit in? This is our issue to fit it all in, because page after page, we're not taking time to build the villain of the given town or whatever. They're just facing them, knocking off one by one. They're doing the whole, and the merry band of travelers went on their way, rescuing city from place to place, type of thing here, all happening in one issue. Throughout this, and when they're not rescuing towns, Bat Wraith is trying to train Green Lantern in utilizing the power and how it's based on will. And if your will's not found on solid things, then the works that your will accomplishes won't either. So you need to do this correctly. It's not enough that you have control over it now. You need to master it even more so. And then as we go through the days are occupied by rescuing people or being trained, while the nights they gather around and they share their lives and their stories. We learn about the kids and how when she was real little, some monsters came after her and her father protected her. She woke up with still in the arms of someone that she recognized as safe. She was too young to obviously realize what was going on. But when her brother found her later, the person that was decapitated, she was still in the arms of her headless father. And the brother is old enough to remember him showing the father showing him the stars and teaching him how to swim and how it's not fair that they lost him and so on and so forth. Then we learn about the guy that transforms. I forget his name.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Regardless, the guy that they rescued from Bat Race Castle, who the monster who transforms back into a man, he was orphaned. He touched one of the obsidian stones. He transformed for the first time as a kid, and he woke up in his normal form, covered in the blood of the things he did in his first transformation. And so he ran until Damona found him. And then we learn a bit more about Bat Wraith and how he betrayed Arthur Pendragon. Couldn't tell if it was real or if it was love or sorcery. And because of his betrayal, he was cursed by Merlin and tethered his soul to his castle. And then when the seeds and everything fell, the castle kind of became possessed by the spirit of William and flew over to New England and fell. We know we're revealed, of course, that Damona is the daughter of the Bat Wraith. They're going along and they talk a bit about how Lunette looks bad. We've been getting hints that she's tired or she's otherwise looking bad or dehydrated. They offer her water. They tell her to rest. We get that here and there. We get the story of Green Lantern and how she found the other lantern whose only words to her were, "I'm so sorry." And then when she was given the power in the flame, she literally caught fire and she doesn't know how long she was on fire. But she woke up and everything around her was burned, as was the corpse of the Green Lantern before her. She made her way back home. She found her dead parents. Not sure how long she was there. She said I held on them for a week or longer. Rats came and vultures. So she was hungry. So that prompted her to move. She was scared about everything that happened. She only fought when she needed to protect herself. And then she was basically running ever since. And that's when we discovered her. And then she talks a bit about the hope she found in terms of realizing that she can share the light. Things like that. They are trying to talk to Lunette, but Lunette has collapsed on the ground behind them. She won't wake up. Green Lantern is obviously very concerned about, she says, "I can't lose you too." And that's when Lunette's brother goes back into his little dreamscape to communicate with Damona and like, "I'm sorry, I got distracted. Please, I don't want to lose her. You need to do this for me." And she says, "Okay, all is forgiven if you wake up in the morning and plant this seed and give it a drop of your tears." And she's saying that New England's getting a tad too bright. It wouldn't want to get a sunburn now, would we? And then she'll snuff out the light herself and she's setting loose some sort of monster. And it says to be continued.
Gar.
Gar, that's his name.
I actually like this issue.
Me too.
I thought if this isn't the best issue of the series, it's certainly up there with the best issue of the series. I was kind of surprised how much I kind of enjoyed it. I don't know if I necessarily really like, we get so many origin stories in this issue. I really don't know if Damona thing, I don't know, but I don't know if I like her origin all that much, but.
I thought you liked Arthurian lore.
I do. I don't necessarily know if I like her being tied to it. And Bat Wraith being her dad and things like that. I guess that might make a little sense. I don't know. I didn't really know, pick up on any vibe that was coming, but then again, reading this book every other month, it's kind of hard to pick up on any vibes and retain it. You may pick up on a lot of vibes, but retaining it's a whole nother story.
It's going to read really good in trade. I get that feeling.
Oh, I'm sure, but it doesn't help put money in the coffers now, though.
No, I enjoyed it. I don't know that we necessarily needed the origin of Gar. I do like that everybody's sharing. So like, I get the point of the origin was to, of the origins were just to show the bond strengthening between the group. So I don't necessarily fault the thing. And plus, Gar's is only one page essentially. Two pages or something like that. It didn't necessarily have the same amount of time devoted to it as necessarily the others. So that's no big deal. I just felt like we kind of saw it anyways from their sort of shared dream state or whatever that they had in that yeah. previous issue. But that's neither here nor there. I wonder what's happening to Lunette. I wonder if maybe the power that she's sharing with the Lantern is burning her out or something. I'm not sure. I don't know what's going on with that. I don't necessarily... There's a piece of the Bat Race story I don't understand. Is like, did his soul possess the castle and it transported itself to New England by his own power and then fell because he couldn't go any further? Like, I don't understand that back half of Bat Race origin there with the castle. But the big thing for me is the arrogance of villains in terms of it's not the first time we've ever seen it in the story, but what makes Damona think she has the power to corral a celestial primordial entity in the universe to do her own bidding and take possession of its power? It says it in the origin here, but although I think maybe we're led to believe that this origin story is being told by her. But assuming she's a trustworthy narrator on it, it says it has no sentience. It's just primordial hunger. Its drive is to do what it was created to do, which is devour darkness. How can she think that she can tame it? Her only experience is what? Earth and her own mother's magic? What does she think she can do here? Why does she think she can do this?
Well, we know the answer to that. It's the whole pride goeth before the fall thing. Everybody thinks they can do everything until they can't. Yeah, it was good. I don't know. In a way, I don't know if fleshing out her origin makes her seem better or not better. At least it's or cooler or non-cooler. I don't know. At least the merry band of travelers is cool, except for Kane, of course, who's kind of been a prick since the beginning of the book. But I guess they're trying to make you feel somewhat sorry for him because of everything that he's lost. He's kind of been almost like driven to this, but that's kind
and
of
remembers that he lost. He's old enough to remember. I don't know. Damona being Morgan Le Fay's daughter makes sense to me, just because anytime we've seen a child of Morgan Le Fay in DC Comics history, I'm personally thinking about the Justice League animated series, because Morgan Le Fay was a villain a couple of times, and her son Mordred or whatever was a very, very spoiled little brat. So her having a spoiled little brat daughter in this universe who she gave everything and tried to conquer the world for and all of this stuff makes sense. It makes more sense for me now that we realize she's Morgan Le Fay's daughter, given what I know about Morgan Le Fay's children in the DC universe. I mean, obviously, we have yet to see how it actually goes, because our final issue, and I believe it's the final issue, solicited for August 27th, because it's only supposed to be 6 issues, right?
I thought it was 7.
I think it's
7.
Maybe
but the solicits. Yeah. Either way, we'll find out soon enough.
Yeah. Yeah. The solicit says, sick of playing games with her food, the Dark Witch Damona takes to the skies, backed by her army of monstrous beast, determined to wipe the Green Lantern off the face of New England once and for all, with a little help from a traitor in Green Lantern's own collective. Like, we don't even know who that is right now.
Well, unless there's more than one.
That's true. But in the art, I really like the art in this issue too. I mean, I don't think it's not any different than what we've seen before. Other than I would say it's a more direct as opposed to trippy paranormal, a little distorted in terms of what you're actually seeing. I think every panel here is
pretty clear in what it's trying to depict, as opposed to being sort of ethereal and weird, like, I don't know, like that dream space they shared in the previous issues and things like we've seen before. I think this one was the most clear in terms of what it was depicting in every panel. Stylistically, it was different.
No, I would concur. I agree with that.
Otherwise, I think that's it. And of course, all of a sudden, we go from three things lit to basically the entire map.
Yes. Playing catch up sooner rather than later.
All right. What's next?
All right. So ever so briefly, since I kind of alluded to it, let's talk Green Lantern sales. So this is the May sales chart. So we have Absolute Green Lantern number 2, which was the big winner. That was actually up number 5. So that actually improved from the number 1 issue, which is shocking from the perspective that it almost never happens. But be interesting to see where number 3 is. But Absolute Green Lantern number 2 was number 5. That's the good news. We can call it a day there. Green Lantern 23, which had a Green Lantern 22 had a nice resurgence, but Green Lantern 23 fell from 95 back to 148. Green Lantern Corps dropped from 74 down to 111. And of course, in May, there was no issue of this title of Green Lantern Dark. So yeah, so we were expecting a trend, at least based on these ICV2 numbers, that Green Lantern was looking up across the board. No, Green Lantern Corps kind of has fallen back down. Actually, I think that's the worst. I think I'm pretty sure that's the worst number that it's had so far. And actually, this is the worst number Green Lantern has had, dropping to 148. So that's kind of abysmal. Now, Comic Book Revolution continues to assert that it has to do with having Kyle in the book and or making Kyle a key part of the book. But I would kind of reject that, since almost when you look at all the other Green Lanterns and all these two books, the only one that's ever actually proven that he can sell a book other than Hal for any period of time actually is Kyle. So if Kyle might not be helping because the storyline isn't great and what they're having Kyle do up to this point has been relatively not interesting. But I don't think it's just because it's Kyle. I think that's reaching the wrong conclusion. But nonetheless, that's pretty much it. So I figured it was worth at least throwing it out there.
Yeah, I like that Absolute is so high. That's nice. I mean, like the Absolute universe is the current in thing. So it's not exactly shocking, but it's still nice to have a Green Lantern title rank so high, regardless of whether it's the end thing or not.
There's currently, in May, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 Absolute titles in the top 25.
Yeah, not surprising. Nope. But still nice to have.
Yeah.
All right. What else? What else do we want to do?
Oh, I think you know what we want to do.
Bum 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 na 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 na. So, actually, you know what? You start. Where do you want to go with this one? How did you feel about it?
I must admit, considering I went in really, like I think I mentioned to you, I know I mentioned it to Jim, that I really expected this movie to be really pretty bad. I did. I didn't think this movie would hold any interest for me whatsoever. And I'm not going to come out. I don't want to pretend that this movie was fantastic or that I probably won't ever watch this movie again. In fact, the saddest part about this is the fact that I know that the raft scene is kind of cool, but I don't know if there's no interesting dinosaur confrontation or battle in this movie that I will ever have any need to revisit anyway, because usually there's at least something that's cool in it. And I guess the raft scene probably would be the cool scene if you were going to. And the stuff on the cliff with the non-pterodactyl pterodactyls was somewhat interesting. But if I thought it was better than I expected to be, it was more or less still what I expected it to be. It wasn't particularly thrilling. It wasn't because you like Jurassic Park 3, which still boggles my mind that anybody does. But because you do, it makes sense that you probably would like this movie more than a lot of people. Since if you like Jurassic Park 3, it's kind of hard not to like this movie because it's almost a verbatim. it's an homage. Let's be kind. It's very, very, very much in the tradition of Jurassic Park 3. And that's being as kind as I can put it, except this had a finished script. to start with when they were making the movie. In the end, and it kind of ends abruptly, but it seemed that seemingly was by design, as opposed to we really don't know how to end this, which is what they did with Jurassic Park 3. But it was okay. I don't know how much it stems the tide of this franchise kind of like going downward ever since Jurassic World. I don't know if it really stops that. But obviously there's still enough interest in the franchise that it still will make a decent amount of money, even over, you know, because people like dinosaurs. So
I mean, I'll try and focus the majority of my comments on the movie, but you brought it up, so I have to defend it. Look, the reason I think The Lost World is shit compared to Jurassic Park 3 is because, look, there's always been a little bit of comedy here and there in these sort of action movies. When you're dealing with death and dismemberment, quite literally, and people being hunted, you got to put in a little levity to sort of balance the film out. Plus, every single one of these fucking films has had kids in it in one way, shape, or form. So you got to have a little bit of levity in there. But because Ian Malcolm was the focus in the second one, there was far more comedy in that movie than any of the others. And the other side of that equation is I hated the second half of that movie in retrospect, because taking the dinosaur and setting it loose on mainland, cool concept, but done really horribly. He's drinking out of a pool. He's eating the family dog. The kid is going to wake up their parents and saying, "Mommy, mommy, there's a monster in the backyard." And we got to have that, you know, moment, you know, there's a big ball rolling down the street and people stopping their car and turning around and in very hilarious ways. We even did a cut scene of a group of Japanese businessmen running away from, "Oh, it's a Godzilla." As a Godzilla fan, I appreciate the homage, but still, that back half of the movie was fucking ridiculous. Now, don't get me wrong, Jurassic Park 3 had its issues. It ended very terribly, so on and so forth, but it was still more of a Jurassic Park movie to me than 2 was.
I can see that argument.
So that's why I like it more than 2. And again, this one had its issues, but I really liked the humanity of a lot of the people that were going out to the island. Obviously, we have the family because we always got to have kids involved somehow. It was nice that every, you know, spoilers, by the way, guys, it was nice that every member of the family survived. That was cool. I was worried about the dad for some point because he kept giving out these pearls of wisdom and having kind of his moment with each of the kids, including his girlfriend or his daughter's boyfriend. And I was like, we're setting him up to have delivered his last words or something like that.
The boyfriend could have died. Yeah, I know they tried to give him somewhat of a redemptive arc in the movie, but if one had to go, he was the one to go.
That's true. Aside from me assuming that the father was going to die, everybody who I thought was going to die died. It's predictable, and that's
predictable.
One of them died comedically early. I think the guy that was out there trying to shoot the Spinosaurus and the Mosasaur.
Yeah.
I thought, because the minute he said his first lines in the whole movie, you're like, oh, he's dead. So like you knew he was shark bait. But I liked we got into it pretty fast. I did a lot of research. Well, I say a lot of research. I watched every Jurassic Park movie in advance of this film, one by one, and took notes on what I thought were either plot holes or things streaming from one movie to the other in terms of, you know, engine and Biosyn and you know, all the shady business dealings going back, you know, even back to the first new movie between Nedry and Hodgkins or Hodgson's or whatever. And then like all this, the weird stuff about the paramilitary group taking over at the end of Jurassic Park World and spiriting away all the samples and stuff like that. But it turns out, I think movie wise, I don't think book wise, all that seems to be resolved. So the only really lingering piece is this bit that we got in Jurassic World Dominion, where they were saying, or Biosyn, their whole thing was they were using the research on the dinosaurs because they were researching how it could impact humanity in terms of finding cures for illnesses and things like that. But we only ever focused on the whole thing with the locusts and the clone girl and the genome of the raptor and so on and so forth, and fixing that problem that Henry Wu had created in terms of the locusts. So really, Biosyn's sort of tagline as to what they were actually, what they told the world they were doing out there, never really got addressed because we never actually saw that research. But it picks up on this movie because, we have the whole idea of them finding the largest species to help with develop a cure for heart disease related issues. So really, that's the only thread. So I don't think it's ever a waste to watch a Jurassic Park movie again, but maybe I wasted my time. I thought ScarJo's character did pretty well. It was not as annoying as I thought it would be. Some people were making it seem very campy and they're really trying to make ScarJo not a pretty like the pretty every girl or something. I was like, God, you're really reaching. I liked her character. I liked her you did the whole thing with like her and the scientist guy, like in the will they won't they, and the little tension between them. I actually, was his name was the Mahershala Ali's, what, I forget, I'm always bad at saying his name. Was his character Henry, was that his name? Or was Henry the scientist? I forget.
Yeah, I think if anything, it was a sign. I'll pull it up. Don't worry.
Well, Ali's character, I actually liked her relationship with him more than the budding relationship with the scientist, because these were just two old opportunists who are kind of at the end of their career. They've both face lots of loss and they don't want to face any more, and they're sort of done with this and they just want to go out. But then, even before they get to the island, Ali's character is talking about like, while we have some time left, let's do some right in the world, things like that. So I really like and plus anytime, even though we didn't know the character, especially towards the beginning of the film, even though we didn't know and spend a lot of time with each of the characters that, of his crew that did end up dying by the time we got to the shore, you felt the loss just a little bit more than average because this was part of his team and both of these people had lost people so much. And they really established that you're like, this is a group of people who really care about each other, even if we, the audience, don't. So I like that. I thought the action with the dinosaurs was great. We have already established mutants in the universe, so like, I don't know that we needed to go as far as we did with God, what do they even call this? The D-saurus or whatever it is.
D-Rex.
The D-Rex. That was, I mean, that's, we're borderline not even looking at a dinosaur even. Nope. We're just straight up creating a monster. But I did like the fact that even though it was like weird and deformed and, a mess of, a mess of CGI, I don't think the CGI itself was bad. It just may be a bad design. But beyond that, you got the sense that this thing was just in pain existing. comically large. And even then we didn't really even see it much in the film. We got it for 15 minutes.
I don't even think, if you're talking actual screen time, I'm sure I wasn't even, in pure screen time, I actually probably would be surprised if we had more than 5 to 7 minutes of it, because this, let's be honest, it really serves no purpose from a plot perspective. It has really nothing to do with why they're on the island, and arguably the...
Oh, the D-Rex, you mean, not the whole movie's plot.
Yeah. D-Rex has, the D-Rex could be completely removed from the movie, and the entire plot of the movie wouldn't change. It's just to give them an obstacle at the end that is something out of the ordinary, and that's it. But it's, Duncan Kincaid is Ali.
Duncan, yeah.
Yeah, Henry is Jonathan Bailey's character.
That's right.
Correct. It was, I mean, some of the plot holes are hard to kind of, the whole thing with the Snickers wrapper in the beginning, that's so stupid.
I mean,
first of all, if it was that ridiculously controlled an environment and they knew it, then I don't think as much of that guy might have been a jerk or careless. I think that would have been better protocols to make sure nobody's eating the Snickers bar even before you go out, even get close to entering the containment area.
Yeah.
Then it's the fact that just as a plot contrivance and or to remind us of the original movie, it's like, oh, the whole system has to completely shut down in order to reboot. Yeah. It's like everything they have contained theoretically or behind or any kind of protection or gate or anything could escape at that moment just because the system, all because it's of a stupid Snicker wrapper getting like pulled into a vent or something, that the entire system has to, and yet the system can reboot supposedly and be okay, but it has to reboot. And by shutting everything down, which we know in the original movie, that was only a Hail Mary because that was all the only chance they had to get the containment fields back online. Okay, we have to, that's the only chance we have is to do like a hard reboot and just shut everything down and bring everything back up. And then maybe it'll work. I mean, even though they don't give a great explanation for it, but at least because I have a big issue with Spinosaurus in general because of what they did in part three.
Mm-hmm.
That, which is, even back then, people knew. The majority, almost every paleontologist knew what they were doing in three was completely unscientific. That was just a whole bunch of people who wanted to be smarter than everybody else and to be the smartest kids in the room. And, hey, we're sick and tired of the T-Rex getting all this publicity, so we're going to try to create a cooler, as in create, you know, publicly, a cooler dinosaur that people are going to say, oh, this is so cooler and much better than a T-Rex, even though even back then people knew that. All the evidence pointed to, hey, a Spinosaurus and a T-Rex might be a mismatch, but it's not a mismatch in favor of the Spinosaurus. And then it's a swamp dweller. It's made for eating things. It's in a swamp. It's not this alpha predator. So an adult T-Rex, an adult Spinosaurus is a massive mismatch in favor of the T-Rex, just like arguably in Dominion 2, that Gigantosaurus or whatever the hell it is. Technically, a T-Rex would be able to take that out too. Because it's got a stronger bite. But
I always thought they should have played around more with like Allosaurus or Carnosaurus.
Yeah, I mean,
they're smaller, but they're still a predator, which they did. And I know you haven't watched it, the Jurassic Park kids show. I'm already forgetting its name.
Cretaceous something?
Camp Cretaceous.
Yeah.
I believe the Allosaur is one of the main meat-eating baddies towards the beginning of that series. Later on, they do they discover their own mutated experiment. But Allosaur is, I think, one of the main predators at the beginning, going after the kids, which makes sense. It's like, small protagonist. Let's get a smaller predator, but still scary.
Yeah, because if you go back to the pre-Jurassic era of dinosaur interest, and that pretty much, other than the T-Rex, the Allosaurus was the thing people focused in on as the predator, which is something I was thinking about. Have we ever had a T-Rex Triceratops fight in this series?
No.
Doesn't that in a way speak volumes about how things have changed? Because that was your classic matchup.
Oh yeah, like all the old stop motion dinosaurs.
Or even beyond that, in books and everything, because there was a logical reason for it. Because a Triceratops if a T-Rex gets the back of its neck or knocks it over, it's going to be dead. But because of those three horns on its front and because of the area of the T-Rex where it can ram them into, it does.
Yeah, we never got any of the traditional fights because, I agree with you in Triceratops being the main one. But for the exact same reasons, T-Rex versus Ankylosaurus or T-Rex versus Stegosaurus had the same kind of wow factor in between, defense versus those teeth.
Right. So. And we haven't even gotten much of the Ankylosaurus. I know that was in Jurassic World because I speed watched Jurassic World again on Tubi the other night. But that's another thing. But it's just the way that everything is. So that's one of the reasons, going back to where I was, that they did Spinosaurus a little more realistic in this movie. And that's one of the things that really annoys me about the third movie is that's like that is so ridiculous. I mean, it's so ridiculous. That's why I was kind of, part of me would have liked either in this movie, or obviously it would be cooler if it was Rexy, in all honesty, if we ever see her again. Just to have another Spinosaurus T-Rex fight, and this time have the T-Rex like take the Spinosaurus out like in like 2 seconds, because that's much more realistic than what they did in that movie. So the water stuff was cool. Like, I think it surprised some people that it happened in the beginning of the movie. They might have thought that was how, you know, that was going to be more at the end of the movie. Which, of course, does raise the question. They're in a much smaller boat trying to escape the island. It's like, what made them think they weren't going to get attacked again somewhere? Even though I guess they were on the other side of the island, but it's not like these things don't swim. The Mosasaur obviously gets around a little bit. But I certainly don't think we don't need any more hidden research sites. Please. Yeah. We don't need that. It's bad.
Well, they sort of opened it up because there was just a whole chain of islands now.
Yes. But it's like, we don't.
It wasn't just site A and site B. It's right. Like, oh, now Isla de whatever.
Yeah, Jesus, it wasn't. Christ. Yeah, it's like it was fine enough when we had Nublar and Sorna. We don't need yet another hidden research facility. But I do agree with you about kind of like the dealing with the humanity aspect. That was one of the cool things about you know the Henry character, the fact that, you know, when he found out basically what they were doing on the island with the mutations and all the stuff, it's like the ones that actually survived as opposed to the majority that just died, that never were viable anyway or didn't live long. It's like, why didn't you just put them down and euthanize them at least? But yeah, it was the D-Rex crossed the line because it doesn't even look like a dinosaur. And I mean, and it did kind of give you, yeah, it was a, and like a Rancor. It was very Rancor like, except for like an extra pair of arms. But I don't know what the hell they're going to do with Dolores in the backpack. I mean, that's kind of a whole problem unto itself.
That's honestly just the fact of what. Why do we have to have kids in these movies?
Actually, I was thinking about this. You're right. We did kind of have it. I was going to say we didn't have one in Dominion, but we kind of did.
Kids. Yeah, they're kids in Dominion. There's kids in every one of these films.
Yeah, I agree. I don't get the point. I mean, I like the Dolores thing. That was kind of cool. But what are you going to do with it? They've already, especially once you're already established that now pretty much if the dinosaurs aren't living near the equator, they're going to die out because of the.
Well, oxygen. I think the family lives near the equator because they were just in the general area. It wasn't like he's taking his children yachting around the globe. He was just going from port A to port B.
Yeah, but I think that they were crossing. I'm trying to remember where he said they were going.
They're from the equatorial area.
Yes, that is true. It wouldn't be the automatic kiss of death. I don't know what you're going to do with that thing.
Yeah.
Depending how big it gets.
No, that's as big as it gets.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I thought we saw.
Well,
the mother. We saw the mother earlier, didn't we?
I don't think it was the mother. I don't think we saw the mother. If I remember right, in terms of, because a long time ago I wanted to be a paleontologist. If I remember right, that particular species doesn't get much bigger than the size of an average large dog.
All right. So I guess I guess that is viable, even though it's so odd. But yeah, it's to me, honestly, the thing that stands out the most was the. Even though that was a little quirky too, because of how stealth like the T-Rex was when he needed to be, but the raft scene was cool, and not just obviously because they lifted that from the original Jurassic book, but just the fact that was something we had not seen before, so that was kind of cool. It was a movie pretty much devoid of raptors for the most part, which was kind of odd, which I'm okay with because
Some genius decided to slap a pair of wings on one of the predators in the world.
That combo thing was weird too. But it really was almost like a greatest hits package from things from the different movies. So it was okay. I mean, it actually kind of made about give or take about as much money in the domestically that I thought it was going to make. Because I know they were originally saying it was only supposed to make like around 130, 135 for the 5 days. I kind of had a feeling it was going to do a little bit better than that. So it essentially more or less did what Dominion in Fallen Kingdom did in 3 days. That's what this movie did in five. So it's still a step down. And the real, and of course, the odds are it's going to take a massive torpedo in the hull this weekend when Superman comes out. But it, considering it only had like about 7 days of uncontested smooth sailing, you certainly can't say it didn't really monopolize and capitalize on the window that it had to make a lot of money early. So it still shows this, which is kind of sad too, because it does show you if they could ever actually, if there is a way to squeeze enough blood from the stone with, from an idea that actually is interesting and is well written and well thought out, it probably could really still, you still could have like a, probably a Jurassic World $200 million plus opening. You probably could, if you actually can could figure out somehow to make this interesting and more unique and not just rehash, which is only, there's only so much you can do, especially since they seemingly ignored the most interesting concept they had, which was dinosaurs in the real world.
Dolores is an Aqualops, Aquilops, roughly the size of a small cat, 2 feet long, 3.3 pounds.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Yep. That's so cool. I was right, but wrong. I said large dog. Whatever. Circling back, because I didn't want to interrupt you, circling back to your point about the Snickers bar in the clean room. Have you ever been in a clean room before, by the way?
I don't know if I have. I don't think so.
When I worked for AMD a long, long time ago, I worked in their wafer fab production plant, which Fab 25 is what it was called, just an abbreviation. But it's a clean room where they produce microchips on silicone, on wafers, and these racks, and they're run through machines and everything like that. That was a clean room. It was a clean room with laminar airflow, which basically means that the floor is a perforated metal sheet, and all the holes are there because in the ceiling, it's not ceiling tile. It's airflow constantly pushing the air down, and the floor is perforated so that the air has somewhere to go to keep the dust particles from going down, or from spreading on anything. So it keeps it all pushed down and clean. You wear full on bunny suits. You go through hand washing stations and sterilization. You put on special shoes for friction. You put on cotton gloves, and then you put on your full bodysuit, and then you put latex gloves over the top of those, which overlap on top of the cuffs of your bunny suit, and then you put on a face mask on top of that, goggles or glasses, and so on and so forth. You're not much like, you know, they said during the pandemic, keep the mask over your nose and everything, as well as your mouth. Don't let it go below your nostrils, all that stuff. Same rules apply in a clean room, because you're not supposed to be breathing particulate and stuff out onto these very clean surfaces that are going through production to become a microchip, basically flash memory storage. So the fact that the dude straight up had his mask down, just having your mask down in a clean room get you all kinds of shit, is, let alone just tearing open a candy bar and having it stick out of your mouth while you're going through it, into a secure area that very clearly has a two-key system with its own security. That place has to have all kinds of eyes on it. So unless this, I don't know. Was this dude like the boss, so he could just get away with it? Like, I couldn't even have.
He was not the boss. I think we know that.
Yeah. So like that definitely there was some real suspension of disbelief there. I think for a lot of people, and I'm sure you agree, the Titanosaurus scene, the whole thing, was pretty great.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Yeah. Just because it's been a while since we've felt awe from these dinosaurs, you know, you don't have that, you know, the first moment that Alan and them pull up in the Jeeps and see the Brachiosaurus for the first time. You don't have that all much anymore in these films, but I felt something akin to it when we had the whole scene with the Titanosaurus, just because of how fucking massive they are. It's like 40-foot dinosaur or something. It was crazy. So that was really cool. And plus seeing the whole herd of them, that was really crazy. The scene on the cliffside was crazy. I have to say this. I went to I went to my theater across the Evo across the highway, and I went for a 10:50 showing. So I did the earliest I could because I knew it was the weekend. It was going to be crazy. My showing, I pick a seat at the end because I'm a larger guy, and if people sit on either side of me, I don't like people feeling like they're squeezed out. So I sit at the very end of the row I pick, a couple of rows back from, you know, the rails or whatever. Everything is fine, and then a family comes and sits right behind me, and they have two kids,
one
the age of my niece, who is 3, and the other the age of my other nephew, who is 2. And they are talking all through the previews, and I just fucking know. I know it's going to happen. the movie, everything goes dark. The movie starts up. They're trying to shush the kids, but they just, is that a dinosaur, mommy? Blah, 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 blah. And I was right behind me. And I wanted to snap. I wanted to lose my shit. I wanted to say something. But I immediately stood straight up. Didn't even like, I wasn't even like trying to sneak off. I almost made a borderline show of standing up and walking down the stairs to go to that front row that nobody, I don't know about you in your movie seat habits, but that front group of rows that's before the railing and then everything starts stadiuming up or whatever.
Yeah, that's like the side, like the front, like the first row of the second level, if you will. That's why I always sit. That's ideally, that's why I always,
about the seats that are like right in front of the screen.
You mean down at the bottom?
Yes. I went to the very back row of there to get away from those people and hearing them. And that almost didn't work either, because every now and then the kids would actually cry, because let's face it, this is one of the more horror Jurassic Park movies. Plus, doesn't even matter. The kids those age shouldn't be at any Jurassic Park movie. So they take the crying kid down the stairs, and instead of going out of the theater, they're waiting in that little dark hallway off to the side, which is behind me. I understand. I try to have empathy for people. Like, maybe you're movie people like Mark. Maybe you're really enjoy movies and the experience of going to theaters, and you have your kids and you're like, man, I haven't been to the theater in so long. I want to try it. Don't take your fucking kids to forget the argument of just trying to take them to any movie. Okay. It's irresponsible to take them to the Jurassic Park movies and things like that, where people are going. There is literally a scene where a dude is bitten in half. There's literally a scene where a pteranodon swallows a man whole. Like, are you fucking kidding me?
What?
Who thinks this is a good idea?
One time, and I remember that. I had to think about it for a second just to remember the movie. When Jason X came out, when Chuck and I went to go see Jason X, this guy took his brought his kid, and I think his kid was like friggin' like five. He must have been like 5 or 6, and he brought him in to see Jason X, and Chuck never used to get fazed by much. You know, like from an eye rolling perspective, it's like that shocked Chuck. It's like, oh my god, it's like, what the hell? Just like one time when we went to the horror marathon they used to have, that somebody actually brought it. Now, of course, you can make a case this was less impactful because it was literally an infant, but it's like somebody literally brought an infant in. It's like, really? I mean, they're not going to be traumatized by it because they're never going to know what's going on. But the reality is that's pretty inconvenient for the other people in the theater. Not that the kid was, I think, especially noisy, but still, it's like, you can, at least that one I can understand the judgment process for, maybe in this, or the dilemma that maybe they literally had no babysitter and they really wanted to do this, so they had to take their kid. But you can make a case for a stupid excuse for the Jason X thing too. But it's like, oh my god.
Yeah, it's even the idea of we didn't have a babysitter. I don't give a shit. Don't go to the fucking movie. Like, I get it. If it's not a scary movie, then yeah, sure, the kids are gonna. I think any audience participants would know. Like, if they're gonna see a more family friendly movie, it's more likely kids are going to be there. But who makes the decision to take a 4 and a 2-year-old to a theater when they're old to see a violent dinosaur movie like this? It makes no sense. Like, I get that there are special instances. People have like these fond memories. Oh, yeah. I remember when my dad showed me, I don't know, fucking Scarface or The Shining way too young or something, two different types of movies. But you know, you shouldn't see at a young age for different reasons. You know, I just have a fond remember. He definitely showed it to me way too young, but I fondly look back on that or whatever. Like, I hear those stories all the time. No one's going to remember fondly screaming in absolute terror as a fucking 3-year old. Watching people be maimed alive on screen. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. People suck. We know that.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't want to be that person who was just causing a scene in the theater, but I have never been so close in my life to whipping my head around and just saying, what in the hell are you thinking? I wanted to say something so bad, but I was just like, look, I barely go out into the public to see these movies in theaters like this anymore. I don't want to just make more drama for myself and, you know, deal with confrontation and shit. I came out here to relax and enjoy myself. And the polar opposite is going to happen if I don't stand up the minute these kids start talking behind my ear when the movie starts. And I'm just going to be like sighing and shaking my head visibly, hoping the parents will catch on if I don't stand up and move right now.
No, unfortunately, you usually know when that's going to happen. How people are during the trailers and the pre-show usually is indicative of how they're going to be in the movies. Once in a while, you'll get surprised. Sometimes you have people who will be way too talkative and laughing way too loud during the pre-show and the trailers, and then actually do shut up when the movie starts. But I would say that's definitely in the minority. So you usually know what's coming, or the person who's playing with their damn cell phone over and over and over and over again, which if that's behind you, as long as they're not taking using the camera, isn't a problem. But if it's in front of you or to the side of you, then every time the light gets brighter on the phone, it's going to be that's the stuff that drives me up the wall, especially when they're adults. I mean, that's even more embarrassing when it's somebody friggin' older, somebody older than
you should know better.
Yeah, you should know better.
But that's about it. It's maybe my fourth or fifth favorite in the franchise. I don't think it like overtakes anything because to be fair, guys, my top three, and no particular order, obviously Jurassic Park 1 being number one, but Jurassic Park 1, Jurassic Park 3, and I actually really like Jurassic World. I hate Fallen Kingdom. I don't know yet if I hate Fallen Kingdom more or less than Dominion. I know that maybe sounds weird, but I really don't like Fallen Kingdom for lots of different reasons. I think it too also suffers from The Lost World in terms of the way the movie's divided in half. I think it suffers from a lot of the same issues and weird comedy and shit like that. But regardless, it's not Rebirth isn't my suddenly my favorite movie in the franchise, but it's somewhere in the middle, and I think that's better than the last movie.
Yeah, I don't know where I would rank this. I don't know if I like. I don't know if I did. I think there were more cool scenes in the last movie, and because I like the original cast coming back together, and the two casts coming together enough where I think Dominion is still more rewatchable than this. I really have a hard time imagining I will ever watch this movie again. And maybe I'll watch the raft scene, but other than that, that's probably going to be it. So I think this is probably one of the least rewatchable ones. And that's.
All right, let's close out.
LanternCast@gmail.com. The website is LanternCast.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, like us on Facebook, #GLCast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean. Please leave us a positive review on any platform you listen to us on. And last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.